Hello, everyone, and welcome to the All Things Military and Veteran Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Gillard. This podcast is brought to you by the El Paso County, Colorado Progressive Veterans. For today's podcast, I was able to speak with Joe Reagan from the Welcome Party. Me and Joe started talking about the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and then that kind of evolves into some other conversations like they usually do. But sit back and enjoy. It's a good conversation with Joe Reagan from the Welcome Party.
So joining me now is Joe Reagan from the Welcome Party. Joe, thanks for joining me.
Hey, well, thanks for having me on, Adam.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure getting to talk to you. You bring such a great experience and breadth of knowledge to any topic that we've had. Today, I wanted to focus on the Ukraine and Russian war, and it's fallen out of favor with the media. With the Israel and Hamas conflict going on right now. But it's still something that drives a lot of our policymakers' decisions. And, so it's something that we still need to, make sure that we're talking about and having a good idea of what's going on. So before we get started on, how it's affecting us, here in the U.S. and our policy and things like that, let's talk about how it's going with the Ukrainians. Joe, what's your thoughts on where the war stands right now?
Well, it seems like we're kind of reaching to a stalemate point. If you look at where the Ukrainians have been talking about where they need to be, we're starting to run into ammo supply issues. On the Russians' front, it seems as if they're running into manpower issues. So both sides are starting to run into that, the issues that you would expect with a long-term campaign like this that seems to have exceeded what Vladimir Putin believed was going to be, what he probably thought was going to be a short campaign, that's now really lengthen things and put a strain on both nations' militaries to provide that. It would appear on the home front that there is a little bit more pushback from on the Russian side. There's been some protests within Russia surrounding draftees, surrounding the deployments, surrounding the challenges facing Russian military families. So there is some pressure occurring in Russia to bring this thing to a close. From a more tactical perspective, obviously going into the winter months, you'll continue to see more of these drone strikes, the artillery strikes, but any large-scale attack or counteroffensive that we saw over the summer is probably done for the time being. Many analysts have identified the fact that the Ukrainian counteroffensive probably did not achieve everything it wanted to, but that's not to say that it wasn't necessarily still a success and that it was able to push back the Russians and really challenge the assumptions that the Russian military was having as to their ability to take and maintain terrain within Ukraine.
You talk about the drone attacks. A lot of the drone attacks going on right now, they're projecting that it's just the Russians trying to waste ammunition for the Ukrainians, just trying to, get them to waste all of their defense systems. Mm-hmm. So that feeds right into other countries' support for Ukraine. Has support been dying down worldwide? Because I hear it here locally that less people are supporting, us giving money to the Ukraine efforts. Is that a worldwide sentiment or is that more localized here?
I think it's more localized here. And I think you have seen the connection made between Ukraine and the Israel-Hamas war as well. In Europe, you don't see those connections necessarily. I think the Europeans are still very, very aware of the fact that our actions in Ukraine directly impact the security of Eastern Europe. Our new NATO allies along the kind of the former Soviet bloc countries still see what happens in Ukraine as really defining their long-term security. And they're looking to the U.S. for that leadership to understand how committed is the U.S. to the region? How committed is U.S.? And I think the challenge here for us is the rest of the world sees Ukraine as an indicator as to how strongly the U.S. wants to support NATO. And domestically, because Republicans have done really tried to tie Ukraine aid with Israel aid, that has really challenged that narrative because that's, again, that the conversation that's happening here in the United States, the two issues obviously are very, very, very different. So not only does that muddle the policy waters, because I think it's important, But obviously going into the election season, that's going to define a lot of what these candidates are talking about. Are we going to pursue more of an isolationist strategy that you see that's pretty much dominating the Republican Party right now? Or will you see more of the internationalist and support of the allies component? How that plays out in Congress, of course, we'll find out in January, because as we go into the, you know, with this new CR that's gone into effect, you'll see going into January, having the budget conversations and really trying to hash those things out. And I think Republicans want to use the foreign aid funding for both Israel and Ukraine as a bargaining chip, because it's really the only thing that they have left. So that the only people that suffer from that is in the short term, the Ukrainians and the Israelis. But in the long term, it's going to have a huge impact on American credibility abroad. If you look historically, when Americans turn to isolationism, that generally means bad things for the world. And it's going to be kind of terrifying when you look at, you know, there were serious isolationist streaks in 1916. And then in 1918, we entered World War I and lost 1 million people. Then same thing in the 1930s with the German, when the Nazis started to make moves in Eastern Europe. You know, U.S. didn't want to get involved, and then ultimately couldn't avoid getting sucked into World War II. And of course, that was a massive just loss of life. So I think these are the types of indicators that we need to be looking for and trying to make sure that we're keeping those things aligned.
We talked a little bit earlier about the, you know, they're in a stalemate right now. Things are kind of slowing down. And now they've had this huge blizzard come ripping through. It's, you know, a 100-year blizzard. I think all Russian ships had to go back to port. There's a minefield that's broken open. So I'm sure there's going to be some, you know, casualties there. Cause now they got mines, just untrackable mines, you know, whatever, in the Black Sea. But, when it comes, you know, to these harsh winters, who is that going to favor more, when it comes to supply lines and being able to restock and get ready for a spring offensive?
I would say in general, it's going to be, as long as the lines remain intact, I mean, both sides appear to have solid supply chains. Obviously, with Ukraine being in their own territory and defending their territory, I would say that that would give them the advantage, because the means of production for them are right there in those communities. And the Russians are operating off of slightly elongated lines. You talk about port facilities, you talk about Crimea, you talk about some of these other strategic areas where the Russians have moved in and have a little bit of a longer supply line. That could definitely create challenges as they try and maintain that. But because these lines, and that's one of the probably the short-term goals of the Ukraine, of Ukraine, would be, can they cut off any portion of the troops? If you look at portions of southwest or southeastern Ukraine, not quite Crimea, but in that general area, you know, there are areas where the offensive did have the opportunity to really kind of get close to closing off some of these supply lines, where it could make challenges to certain isolated Russian units slightly more challenging. So that it could be interesting to play out. If we look at last winter, you didn't see a whole lot of movement. So I think the expectation would be that you'd see both sides kind of hunker down and make this more into a, you know, wait for weather to improve. I mean, this is a tank and artillery war. So mobility is a challenge, and mobility is especially challenging in winters like we're experiencing right now.
You mentioned the tank and mobility war. Did you see the news? Their tank factory got hit recently by a drone strike, the Russians tank factory, which is the furthest behind line strike of the war. And the Ukraine intelligence actually like claimed it too. They actually took credit for it. So,
and that's smart. I mean, that's exactly what you have to be doing during this time period, is not just focusing all your efforts on the front, but really trying to expand that and look into what are those strategic targets that exist that you can't strike. The Ukrainians have shown a tremendous amount of resiliency and innovation in their ability to take non-traditional assets and use those as weapons. So if you look at some of the drones the Europeans are making, these are not necessarily expensive drones. So a lot of this is fairly inexpensive. It's, dare I say it, handmade, homemade. You know, so they're leveraging some elements of the of almost the insurgent handbook to be able to maintain the supplies that they have, and that's the challenge for the Americans and the Europeans, is looking at this as, you know, you do have to understand what is the production capability across NATO to keep those arms flowing into Ukraine. I mean, now we've provided fighter jets, we've got tanks, but it's artillery shells that really have been the make or break component of this conflict so far, at least as it would seem. So those are the things that we have to look at, because while there are stores of these things, it's at some point somebody does have to make a decision and say, we're going to start producing more of this in order to ensure that we have the necessary ammunition to support the Ukrainians without necessarily compromising either our own or our European allies' supply.
Mm-hmm. So with Russia, focused on Ukraine, they still have greater desires in the area, and their neighbors are recognizing that too. And was it Finland that just closed their final border with Poland recently? The tensions with other nations around there, are they gearing up? Are they starting to militarize their borders with Russia also?
You know, it's interesting that we're having this conversation on the day of that Henry Kissinger died, because one of the last observations that he made about the Ukraine conflict was that while you could see this, and it's fairly easy to view this as the Russians trying to regain their empire, for this is Putin trying to rebuild the old Soviet state. Mm-hmm. It's also an indication of severe weakness. And we see that in a number of different things within Russia. Public opinion is not great. Now it's repressed, and so that makes it a little bit more challenging. But there are issues with the Russian economy. There are issues with Russian growth. There's issues with domestic issues. So these are all challenges facing the Russians. So the question is Vladimir Putin going to open another front? And the answer is, all indicators say that he doesn't have the resources to do so. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean he won't. It doesn't mean it's going to be disastrous, but it doesn't appear like that would be something that he would want to do. I think he's also very aware, and this is the challenge for U.S. policymakers and European policymakers at the same time, because how we support Ukraine ultimately shows the strength of NATO. And that is what's really why, and that resonates not just within Russia, but within China as well. And that's another component that we often don't talk about is with Xi Jinping and his recent efforts to come back to the United States and meet with President Biden. You know, how do the Chinese play into this as well? And that's kind of that in the side of all the whole world is watching how we support Ukraine, because that defines how we're going to also support places like Taiwan. And I think initially, both the Russians and the Chinese probably believed that NATO had lost its influence and that the NATO alliance wouldn't come to the defense of Ukraine. And that support, having now lasted 2 years, does show the strength and relevancy of the alliance. If Republican policymakers continue to push back on that and say that it's not worthy to invest in, that's going to cause not only our own NATO allies to question whether the U.S. is truly committed, but it's also going to show the rest of the world that the United States isn't committed to those types of alliances, which will hurt us in the long run in many, many ways. So that's why, from the policy perspective, from the policy stance, this is really so important that we're able to provide that support to Ukraine.
With it's been said recently that Vladimir Putin wants to wait until after our election to really kind of, you know, concede anything or, you know, kind of make his next big strategic moves. To me, that kind of sniffs of like the Iran-Contra type stuff, where it concerns me that somebody in like another foreign power is saying that he's tying so much of his policy to our like out front like that. Mm-hmm. And like, who's going to, you know, cater to that? And then that really concerns me. But what are your thoughts on him? Did the reports being that he's tying it so closely to our election?
Well, what would you do if you were in his position? You think, look at what both parties are, look at the presidential candidates and what they're proposing. And it's not really difficult to see that any Republican candidate has a more sympathetic view of Russia than the Democratic candidate. And so it would seem like that's not even a conspiracy. That's an observation that you can make by reading the Washington Post any morning. And you can see that the Republican policy does tend to favor the Russians. And if Donald Trump or any Republican is elected to be president of the United States, then it is likely that they will cater to Vladimir Putin and what he wants and give him more favorable terms than what the Democrats will provide him with.
And you think that message is being pushed pretty hardly by the Democrats, that, you know, that's the bottom line right there. You know, like they will favor Russia, or their policies will favor, you know, Russian interests more. Do Democrats do a good enough job pushing that message?
No, of course they don't. The Democrats are doing a horrible job messaging everything. You know, and this is
policy.
This is a great example. So Welcome Party, we've been doing a bunch of polling here in El Paso County and trying to get people's views on things. And I sat through a fascinating conversation yesterday talking about Bidenomics and why Bidenomics is failing. So the employment rate in the United States is something like, it's under 3, it's like somewhere around 3%. And so don't quote me on these numbers, but I'm using this as examples, right? So 3% unemployment rate is pretty good. Everything the Democratic Party is talking about, everything Bidenomics is talking about jobs. If you ask a voter what they care about, it's not jobs, because most of us are employed.
Mm-hmm.
We're worried about prices.
Right? Exactly. Cost of living. As soon as you said that was my first thought. Like, it's cost of living.
And I don't want to pivot the conversation because I want to keep it on Ukraine. But the common theme here is that the Democrats are talking about things that don't matter to voters. And because of that, they're not getting credit for the policy successes that they're having, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, inflation is down. Prices are actually down. Gas prices are down.
I was shocked at how low my gas price was the other day.
U.S. oil production is up. So all of these things that everyone's saying, well, Biden's crushing the oil industry. Well, oil's cranking up more than they have in years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've had more favorable terms to pumpers. So, those are the kitchen table issues that some of our polling has uncovered. It's saying, listen, the Democrats are having huge policy successes on these issues that are important to Americans, but they're not talking about them. Yeah. And that extends to foreign policy as well. And that's another example of, no, the Democrats are not doing a great job of really talking about the issues that are impacting foreign policy and how these things like Ukraine, like Taiwan, like Israel, Hamas, how this actually is going to impact the worldview and why it's important that the U.S. gets involved in these areas and how the U.S. is going to get involved with these areas, right? If you remember, think back to 2008 during the vice presidential debate. And at the time, the candidate for vice president, Joe Biden, he had talked about that he has a decades-long relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu. And this is something that could be a tremendous asset to us. If you want to talk about control, wherever you stand on this, right? The one relationship that's really going to drive this is going to be the relationship between Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu. And so how do we leverage, right? Why are we not talking about that? Why are we not talking about this decades long relationship and saying, listen, if Donald Trump comes in, Benjamin Netanyahu does not like him. He initially did, But then he came back and said the only thing that they did was they moved the embassy to Jerusalem. And other than that, the United States government under Donald Trump was no friend to Israel. And we don't talk about these things.
Oh, yeah, not at all. Yeah.
Yep. So I think we need to be having more open conversations about and about these threats and be aggressive with these concepts of, listen, Republicans want to cut foreign aid, and that is going to mean that it might not be this year, it might not be next year. But let me tell you, if you have a kid in eighth grade, I'd be worried if Republicans get elected. I would be very worried. Because those are the kids that will face the impact of not getting involved in Ukraine today. So, you know, but those are the types of policy things that we need to be talking about. This is where guys like Jake Sullivan should be out in front of the media every day and screaming from the top of their lungs that it is the Democrats that are serious about national security. It is the Democrats that are serious about, you know, defense. The Republicans do not have a serious platform on anything, and it shows. And they're damaging. Go ahead.
So how do you get that out there, though? Because, I mean, people have selected their sources of media already, right? He could stand up there and say that all day. That's going to get very little airplay on Fox News, you know? And, you know, that's the biggest market there is. How do you get the message out to the folks that just don't tune into things like that? And the algorithm is so set against you now. So like your Facebook ads, all the same things.
You know, it's building those trusted voices across the aisle. Again, a strength of Joe Biden. He's worked across the aisle for decades in the Senate. Is very, very well versed, has many friends on both Republican and Democratic side. You know, this is the opportunity to engage with moderate Republicans, right? The Welcome Party exists. Yeah, sure, we're trying to expand the reach of the Democratic Party. But at the same time, we see that there's a large cohort of Republicans that no longer fit in the Republican Party because the Republican Party has gone so far to the right that they don't even represent conservative values anymore. And so, you know, I know a lot of more progressive Democrats might say, well, you know, oh, well, Joe Biden is a moderate. Like, he's not doing anything that we want him to do. Well, that might be true if you're a progressive Democrat. But in terms of the broader policy content, he's accomplishing quite a bit. And it's because he's able to do that. And I think, you know, I had a call earlier with some folks from the America First Caucus earlier today. And that was one of the things that came up is now the time for a third party. Because the parties have gotten so polarized on both sides, do they even represent what the typical American believes in?
Right. And
the answer is no. We don't need a third party right now because if Donald Trump gets elected again, it's going to be a disaster.
Yeah.
A complete disaster.
I wish we could do it at like different levels. So, you know, not at the presidential level. I wouldn't want a third party candidate, but down ballots. I think like it'd be nice if we could get more support for down ballot third party candidates.
Well, and this is where I think, you know, Problem Solver Caucus, America First, you know, or not America First Caucus. You know, some of these moderate groups that are out there that work, you know, the bipartisan middle ground, right? Mm-hmm. Just because we have a two-party system does not mean we have a multi-party dynamic. Because when you really dig into it, right, the Democratic Party is two, maybe three different parties. The Republicans are probably like six different parties. But they're just like you see in European Parliament, there's a lot of policy areas where there can be agreement, and it's highlighting those areas where you now have, right, is Joe Biden the one to deliver the message that American foreign policy that we're doing, that support for Ukraine is incredibly important for national security? Is he the one that should be on Fox News talking about that? Well, he's the president, so yes, but it should also be, you know, who is the responsible Republican that can speak up and say, you know, hey, what the administration is doing is correct, and this is the right solution? And there are those Republicans that are out there. And it's been the biggest concern for me as someone that has voted for both Democrats and Republicans is that it would appear that Republicans have adopted this moral cowardice and unwillingness to speak up. And you've got guys like Mitt Romney, who might be one of those voices that can speak up in moderation and say, listen, you know, I don't agree with Joe Biden with everything, but this is important and this is being done right. And right. So that's where we need, especially from congressional leaders, from the Senate leaders, to really amplify this bipartisan component of saying, listen, it needs to go back to the old way of national, you know, politics ends at seashore. And when we talk about national security issues abroad, we need to have a united front in these things because there is a right and wrong answer. And right now the Republicans are advocating for the wrong answer.
Yeah. We've seen, you know, a few Republicans stand up, you know, Liz Cheney, and then, you know, she got, you know, punished for that. Mm-hmm. Like, is there any indications that, you know, in the next election cycle that the Republicans might swing back towards the middle, or are they just going to keep pushing these extreme candidates further and further to the right?
It's a great question. When you look at polling, it tells us that there should be a better chance. So, and I'll stick to El Paso County because we've done a lot of polling here. If you look at El Paso County, as far as polling goes, there should be a good chance that the right Democrat could really succeed here. When you look at what Mayor Yemi was able to pull off with his campaign, like he pulled together a bunch of different groups that were kind of tired with what was happening and found electoral success. There's those pockets that exist. And the greatest challenge that we face on either side, whether you're a moderate Republican or moderate Democrat, is you need to convince this group of people that has it in their mind that has bought into this lie that voting for one party or the other is going to destroy something. Mm-hmm. Right? Voting for a Republican is not in El Paso County is not going to destroy the country. Voting for Doug Lamborn could destroy the country. You know, if you're a Republican, you know, voting for whoever our local AOC stand-in might be probably not the right person to vote for. But there are Democrats in this community that align with the values of this community, and it's finding those people. So I think there's a way. I think it's going to that's one of the reasons why Welcome Party has gotten so involved so early. Right. That's why I'm out there all the time engaging with people to have these conversations when we're still, you know, over 350 days from election day. Because it's going to take a long time to get out there and convince some of these moderates to say, listen, you don't belong to the Republican Party anymore. You think you do, but you don't. Look at what Doug Lamborn did. Look at the other day, right? He had Doug Lamborn's senior advisor, you know, signed on to the El Paso County GOP committee signed off on a letter asking the district attorney to prosecute people for books, right? Hmm. Right. Using, talk about using the justice system as a weapon. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Doug Lamborn's office is advocating to use the DA to prosecute teachers and educators and parents. Mm-hmm. Because of the books that they're putting in front of kids, right? Does that align with anyone's values? I'm sure it does some people, but I would say that, you know, walking around the neighborhood, and I know plenty of Democrats and Republicans, I don't think that aligns with most people's values. So if you believe in book banning, yeah, go ahead, vote for Doug Lamborn. But if you want someone that actually believes in things, there's better people out there, much better people out there.
Yeah, I've seen that thing that they endorsed for the DA. It was such small snippets of all these stories and things like that they put into that to justify the banning or trying to ban these books and things like that.
You know what one of them was? You know what one of them was? This is a great example. One of those books was a, I can't remember the title of it, but it's about a young kid who is in a Japanese internment camp. And he and his dad decide that they want to start a baseball league because they want to remind everyone that even though they're in this internment camp, that they are Americans. And baseball is as American as you can get. And even though they're in this situation, they are going to show their American pride. Think about that story for a second.
They want to remove that.
Do you? Yeah, that's what they want banned. Do you have any issue with your kid reading about baseball and loving America so much that you want to play baseball in an internment camp?
Yeah, that is.
And it reminded me of, I've worked with a bunch of different veterans groups and a couple of years ago worked to get it was the only all women, all black unit to deploy during World War II. It was called the 8666 or 6888, sorry, 6888. And, spoke with one of the surviving members and she said something that was absolutely amazing to me. And she said, we signed up because we wanted to show how much we loved our country, even though our country didn't love us. And I thought that was such a powerful statement on so many different levels, because it talks about that's true patriotism, right? Mm-hmm. That's true patriotism. These women signed up to serve in World War II because they loved this country, even though they didn't have full rights at the time. Right. And it's because of them that amazing things happen. And those are the types of books that Republicans are trying to ban. And that, and to me, like I said, that is the antithesis of the values represented by the vast majority of people living in El Paso County.
So I can almost guarantee you there's going to be a book inside that library about Daniel Inouye, the senator from Hawaii. He was in an internment camp, became a leader over in the European theater, had his arm blown off in combat, mm-hmm. like, ragged his guys to get back into the fight and everything, like an absolute American hero. But yeah, it's the same thing though. From a Japanese internment camp, he still felt that patriotic duty to come through and then continue to serve. He was, one of Hawaii's first representative, and then into the Senate, just an absolute legend. You're going to take that book out of the library?
It's because of weakness, right? It's pure weakness and cowardice, because Republicans are afraid to admit that the U.S. has made mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. Who hasn't made a mistake? Yeah. Granted, the U.S. has made some pretty big mistakes over the years, but generally speaking, I don't know. I've traveled the world, and I got to say, U.S. is pretty darn good, right?
Yeah.
We got our flaws. I've yet to find someplace better.
Man, I was in Munich in 2008, mm-hmm. and the Obama election was going on, things like that, and the German, European crowd there was chanting for Obama. Like there's still that hope out there that we're going to have a leader that's going to, take us and help us do better, and do things better for the world. It was a weird contrast, going from the George Bush era into that Obama era and seeing the hope that, having a good leader provides for the rest of the world.
Yep. You're absolutely right. And that's why these elections are so important. And, another thing we've been working on is the Colorado District 5 congressional election last cycle was one of the least expensive races in the state of Colorado. And David Torres, had us, pulled 40% of the vote at 19 cents per vote. And to put that into perspective, in CD3, Lauren Boebert and Adam Frisch, that race was averaging over $30 per vote.
Holy cow.
It was one of the most, that's the most expensive, right?
Yeah.
And I say that for this reason. You talk about resources and how you amplify the message of what's really going on. Right. David Torres got his message out there and was able to attract 40% of voters to say, yeah, I want someone other than Doug Lamborn. And he did that with nothing. Nothing.
Yeah.
If we dedicate the resources to really get the voice out for what the Democrats are doing, not just locally, but statewide and nationally, these are things that really are a lot more aligned with the values than anything the Republicans are doing. Right. Republicans talk about freedom of religion. they're not doing freedom of religion. They're imparting their religion on others.
Right. Yeah.
You know, Republicans talk about being pro-life. They're not pro-life. They're they're trying to impart their beliefs on others. If they were really pro-life, they'd be doing the pro-family policies that the Democrats are trying to instill so that women never have to make those types of choices. But if they have to, it's available.
Yeah.
You know,
and now we have studies, like even up in Denver, of how education programs, you know, prevent things, teen pregnancies. So they're still fighting that the funding for that, though. And like, I think that stuff needs to be pushed out. Like, cool, you didn't want to do it 10 years ago, but now we have some more data, and it's proven that, you know, education is the way to treat, you know, young women, to make sure that they know what the resources are and everything like that. And it cuts down on all of this. Mm-hmm. But not funding things like that. It just always kind of blows my mind. You did talk about, you know, getting messaging out, and, you know, we talked a little bit about trying to, you know, reach the Republican side, you know, the moderate Republicans. Even within the Democratic Party, like you touched on, you have a wide, you know, breadth of thoughts, mm-hmm. you know, which is awesome, which is what we want, yep. right? Yep. But how do we coalesce that, you know, all these different groups within our own party in order to, you know, like I said, put together strong candidates and support strong candidates so that, you know, we're not wasting resources?
Well, it all comes down to what do we really stand for and what are our values? What is it as if when we think, and I always think back to my grandfather, when he talked about, you know, it was the Republicans that gave me my job, but the Democrats that gave me my rights. And right, it's those types of simple statements, because that fundamentally hasn't changed, right? If you dissect every policy issue, what Republicans are looking for is, at best, they're trying to support big business leaders, trickle-down economics, all these things that we've experimented with for decades that just don't work.
Right, exactly.
And it's proven it does not work.
Yeah.
And the Democrats on the other side have continued to stand up for individual liberties, true individual liberties, tried to stand up for workers, and we've seen those policies, right? So go back to policies that are succeeding right now that no one's talking about, right? When adjusted for inflation, wages are starting to go up. Right. So we're starting to see that wage gap decrease, which is the first time it's happened in like decades. Right. That's a success, because if you are, if you are a working class family, it might not necessarily feel like it, but your stance is actually improving because the Democrats have fought those policies to do that. Yeah.
Like which one specifically drove that?
Well, it's...
Yeah. So we could driving some.
Well, and we could have an entire conversation around the economics of how how do these things happen? Because through the pandemic, inflation was driven by pandemic spending, right? At the end of the day, right? How do we measure inflation? You know, government spending is a huge component of that. And so when government is spending in a deficit, that is the number one thing that's going to drive inflation, because you're literally pumping money into the economy. And it's accounted for. So it's not like you're just printing money and letting it run. Like, there's an accounting for that, but that's driving that. And so if you had asked me in 2019 what's going on, and I would have told you, right? So there was fundamental issues in the labor market that existed from a number of different reasons, right? There was a labor shortage. Wages were not aligning properly. There was a skills gap in many different industries. And then the pandemic happened, and that exaggerated like all of these things. And we're lucky it didn't fall apart, right? So as crazy as it sounds, credit to the Trump administration for opening up the purse and spending a whole bunch of money and flooding the market in order to prevent the economy from really collapsing. Mm-hmm. However, you look at that and you know that that's going to drive inflation over the period. So what was missing from that was, how do you balance that safety net? How do you balance that additional government spending with what was necessary to prevent the inflation? The Fed is doing okay with it. All right. But that's independent, right? That's not a political decision. The Fed makes that decision independently. So at the national level, you know, increasing subsidies for certain industries, really spreading out. Like the president was down in Pueblo the other day talking about, you know, the world's largest windmill builder down there, right? Exactly. These are creating manufacturing jobs back in communities that, you know, used to be working somewhere else and still have, they still have the infrastructure in place to have large industry like that, but that large industry is dried up. So by investing in new jobs and using the existing workforce, retraining the workforce, investing in your workforce, investing in your workers, you know, that's enabling these new jobs to come in that, you know, it's going to grow, right? That's the other thing. And this is, I had a conversation with someone the other day talking about oil markets and they were getting all upset. I said, well, listen, like the sooner we move to green energy, then we're not going to be, you know, slave to OPEC, right? Because at the end of the day, OPEC knows how much it costs to drill here in the U.S. And I got news for you. The economics of how much it costs to pull a barrel of oil out of Texas versus how much it costs to pull a barrel out of the Gulf is drastically different. And the Saudis know that. And the Saudis manipulate the prices to ensure that U.S. oil producers aren't making the same profit that they are. You know, that's a system that we need to build, that we need to break. And you can do it by pushing to green energy. And you can do it when you encourage the workforce to do that as well. You know, so it's a complex thing. And because it comes down to, you know, investing in education, investing in workforce, investing in infrastructure, all these things. It all comes together to build that. And a lot of it is, you know, some of it is government spending, some of it is encouraging private spending, some of it's public-private spending. You know, there's a number of tools, and the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, did a decent job. Is it perfect legislation? No. But it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. And it is addressing a lot of issues and allowing us to start to make progress on these things. We still haven't addressed housing though, right? That's another, you know, affordable housing is an issue that we haven't really figured out yet. That one's a little bit more long-term because the housing market's always been a little freer. So, you know, that's one that maybe policy is going to be a lot more difficult to solve. And we see that here locally too. So,
So back to Russia and Ukraine, man.
We went full circle.
Well, you know, I see the time here, and man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule and talk to me. So always great insights with everything. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. No, it's a great conversation, and you know, to bring it full circle with the Ukraine Russia component, right? So much of this is connected. So many of these policies have an influence on different aspects of our lives that is really difficult to understand, and it does require a lot of effort to dig into some of these things. You know, when we look to 2024. We're going to need elected officials that are able to make difficult decisions and communicate that back to the majority of us that might not necessarily have the same insights. And, you know, you look at the new speaker's stance on a lot of these issues. There was a great observation that was made, right? As a just kind of a regular member of Congress, he did not have access to classified briefings. As Speaker of the House, he has access to classified briefings. And you'd be surprised that after getting some of those classified briefings, his stance on Ukraine shifted pretty quick.
Really?
And that's where, you know, we need people that we can trust in these offices because they are going to have access to information that the majority of people won't.
It kind of frustrates me that we're electing people that don't understand the complexity of the issue to begin with. I think there needs to be a higher standard. Like I get the qualifications that the Constitution lays out, but we need to have a higher standard for our elected officials in general.
And that's on us, right? That's on us. Each and every one of us using our vote as an opportunity to say that this person does or does not represent my values. So, and I'll say it again, if you can look at Doug Lamport and say that man represents my values and what I believe should be representing me, go ahead, vote for him. I'm willing to bet the majority of people in El Paso County don't see that. And right. I think there's a lot of great candidates that are out there that, yourself included, that, you know, certainly could, you know, be a much better representation of our community.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah. And I agree. We definitely have a lot of good options out there, a lot of better options, you know, so, thanks again for your time, Joe. And, yeah, we'll be in touch.
Thanks, Adam.
And here's a quick word from our sponsors. The All Things Military and Veteran podcast is proudly sponsored by Native Roots Cannabis Company, Colorado's leading locally grown and owned dispensary chain. Native Roots has been our largest donor since we were founded 4 years ago, and we thank them for their support. They have 20 locations in Colorado, and Native Roots is ready to educate and serve recreational and medicinal patients alike. So thank you for listening to the All Things Military and Veteran podcast. We can be found on over a dozen podcast apps, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. We hope you find our programs rewarding and informative. Please check us out on the web at epccpv.org. You can sign up for our newsletter there, and feel free to drop us a line at info@epccpv.org. Thanks for listening. Hope you're having fun out there.